Have you ever thought about God's methods? Just thought about that. What are God's methods? You ever wondered about that? How he does this, how he does that? Try to figure out what he's doing so that you can understand where you're going, and you try to figure everything out, and you are trying to understand God's methods. At this part of the year, this season of our life, in the part of Christmas, we begin to wonder about God's method. And so today I want to talk to us about God's method, the miracle of the method he used to save humanity. And so I want you to know that God's methods are nothing like ours, in case you hadn't figured that out yet. The methods of God are virtually, they're astounding. And we are hard-pressed to try to understand them and try to comprehend them. And so today what I want us to do is to be able to appreciate that God is in control, regardless of how he does it. And we're going to look at how he's done some things in the past, and how he has used methods that we wouldn't naturally think that he would use. And so today in chapter 11 of Romans, there is a verse, a few verses that are basically what we would call a hymn. They may be set out as a poem in your translation. And what it says is it talks about how God is. Verse 33 is where we're going to start, and we're going to read through verse 36. Paul says this: "Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and of the knowledge of God, how unsearchable his judgments and untraceable his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor, or who has ever first given to him and has to be repaid? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him, to him be the glory forever. Amen." Romans chapter 11, verses 33 through 36 give us this little glimpse into the methods of God. And so when we're talking about the miracle of the method of God, the first things we need to understand is that God's methods transcend you. God's methods transcend you. Now, what do I mean by that? Transcend is a word that we don't use a whole lot, but transcend just basically means to go above. It is out of your realm. It goes above you. It goes over your head. It's out of your possibility of understanding. It's out of my possibility of understanding. And so God's methods transcend us. In other words, God's methods are beyond our comprehension. And Paul captures this in this hymn. God's methods are way beyond our conversation. If you were to write a script of redemption, if you were to write a script of how God would save the world, I promise you it would be very different than the one that he's written. If you are God, think about this. If you are God and you say, how do I save man? Would you do what God did? Would you do some things different? You think there's some things you might do better. You probably wouldn't have written the same thing. You wouldn't include some of the things that God has. Yet he chose to reveal himself in the greatest, grandest possible way that we can understand. How do we understand God? How do we understand what God has done? How do we understand what God is doing? How do we understand his methods? And there's this story of this little boy. And there's a teacher who's trying to help him understand what's going on. And there are ants around. And the little boy is watching the ants crawl around on the dirt. And the teacher said, if you wanted to communicate with the ants, how would you do it? So the little boy thought and thought, and after a while he says, well, I guess I would become an ant. And that's exactly what God did. How does God communicate to us who are beings who can't comprehend what he says, or in language that doesn't really capture all that he is. How does God tell us the truth of who he is? He becomes man so that he can communicate to the world his glory. Jesus, last week we looked at the verse in John, I think it's John 10, that says, I and the Father are one. In another part of John, he says, if you've seen the Father, you have seen me. And Jesus is communicating who God is. God chose to be born to humble, poor parents. He chose to be born to a young couple whose hearts were pure, but who held absolutely no worldly influence. Think about this. If we're writing the story, do you make Jesus be born to Mary and Joseph? Poor, peasant people living in a town called Nazareth. It's one of those towns where people are like, is anything good ever happened? As a matter of fact, somebody said, he's from Nazareth. Has anything good ever come out of Nazareth? It's like that town that nobody wants to go to. That town you always talk bad about. It's those bad people. They do crazy things there. It's this or it's that. You don't want to be from that place. And they're like, oh, he's from Nazareth. We wouldn't have picked Nazareth. We wouldn't have picked him to be born in Bethlehem. We wouldn't have picked these things for him to be born to a poor Jewish girl and a guy named Joseph. We wouldn't have did that. We would have picked maybe some royalty, some people who would have had some influence, some folks who would have been able to pronounce the king is here. Our methods would have been very, very different than God's. But really, this shouldn't surprise us that he picks a poor couple who are pure in heart but have absolutely no influence. It really shouldn't surprise us, because when you think of God's methods and you think how God has worked in the past, you go to the Old Testament and you begin to study and to read the stories and look at what God does, and you see him calling a guy named Abram who doesn't worship the gods of his fathers but worships God himself, and he calls him from a faraway land and he says, just start walking, and Abraham says, okay. And God promises a 90-year-old man, when it happens, a 100-year-old man and a 90-year-old woman, that they would have a child together. And God finally does that. God's methods are not our methods. You go to the guy who would be his great-grandson or great-great-grandson, Joseph. Joseph is one of the youngest brothers. He is thrown in prison. He is a guy who gets accused of a variety of things. He is a slave in a foreign land, yet God picks him and raises him up to save a nation from starvation and extends to a whole region, saving them from starvation. We wouldn't have picked Joseph. We would have let Joseph rot in jail. God's methods are not our methods. You go on a little further in their history and you find this guy named David. Now, David's a pretty boy. He's a shepherd. He's the youngest of the group. He has several older brothers, and God says it's time for a change in the king. And so the prophet goes, and the prophet again and again and again says, well, this must be him, because look, he's tall. He's got the macho body. He's got the military style. Surely this is the guy to lead us. And God says, nope, nope, nope. And finally, Samuel, who's the prophet, gets through all of the brothers, and he's like, okay, God told me to come to your house, Jesse. Are you hiding anybody? And Jesse says, well, there's a scrawny rat out in the fields with the sheep. Bring him in. And God picks him, the pretty redheaded kid. The guy who nobody expects anything great to come of. The guy who is thrown out in the pasture to take care of sheep, away from the family, away from everything. God's methods are not our methods. Think about the place where Jesus is born. He's born in a town of Bethlehem, which is about 5 miles from Jerusalem. Bethlehem is a very small town, a very insignificant town that is part of a very insignificant tribe. The tribe of Benjamin is where, was who owned the town of Bethlehem. Now, the tribe of Benjamin is the smallest tribe, the least significant tribe, so much so that it just gets absorbed into the tribe of Judah. And Bethlehem, nobody goes to Bethlehem. There's nothing there. Yet God picks Bethlehem, the smallest, the most insignificant city from the most insignificant tribe for his son to be born in. God's methods are not our methods. Over and over and over again, God will choose the plain and ordinary things and ordinary people to do ordinary work. Now think about yourself. Besides those of you who have a little more hubris than the rest of us, you probably consider yourself to be very ordinary. A nobody. I'm nothing. I'm the middle child in my family, which apparently there's a syndrome with that we're no good. But, so middle child syndrome that we have these issues. why would God pick me to do anything? Maybe you're a child from a family that has all kind of problems. You've got alcoholism or drugism or whatever other ism in your family history, and you're like, God is not going to pick me. I am useless. I am worthless. I have nothing to give him. And we're reminded over and over again that God's methods are not our methods, and God picks the ordinary, mundane things and people of this world to change it. God picks a poor family in a village that no one goes to give birth to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. When you think about your life, you say, I have nothing to offer. Neither did Bethlehem, neither did Mary and Joseph, neither did any of the other folks I named. Yet they were willing to be used by God. Are you? Are you? See, God's methods are not our methods. His methods transcend us, or they go beyond us. It's hard for us to comprehend. But what even compounds this fact is that not only does God's methods transcend us and goes beyond us, is that God's methods include us. God's methods include us. That is crazy. That's crazy. If you look, I think it's verse 35, and he asks the question, who does God owe? Who does God have to repay? It's a rhetorical question. It's one of those questions. Is he is so above us. He is so beyond us that there is no way that he owes anybody anything. He is the provider. He is the source. He is the only one who gives life. How can he owe us anything? And it's a rhetorical question where the answer is absolutely no one. God owes no one anything. Yet, God uses us. No, he doesn't owe us. He doesn't have to repay us. This is not anything kind of favor that God is doing for us on our behalf. Yet he says, hey, I want to use you in my plan. I want to use you in what I'm doing. I want to use you in changing the world. Think about that. You say, I'm useless. I'm mundane. There's nothing great about me. There's no good thing that comes from Eunice or Mamu or Riedel. What good am I for God's glory? I'm a last child. I'm a middle child. I'm X, Y, or Z. And God says, I understand all that. I don't owe you anything, but I want to use you anyway. My family, one of our traditions as a family at Christmas time, before we open gifts, either with my extended family or my nuclear family, is that we read Luke 2. And that may be a practice that you do as well. We read the story of Jesus' birth. We talk about what Jesus has done and the fact that he has come. We pray, we give thanks, and then our kids go crazy. But we try to infuse the gospel in there somewhere. And there's this little portion in that story that we all know that it gets shown in nativity scenes. It gets told over and over again. And it's this little story or this little passage starting in verse 8 through 11 about these guys who are out in the field, and we call them, or they're called shepherds. Shepherds are out there. They're working on, they're taking care of the sheep at night to make sure that nothing comes in, nothing, they don't run away, no wolves or predators come and take the sheep, and they are on the clock 24/7. And starting in verse 8, it tells the story of when the angels come and speak to them. Check out what it says. It says, in the same region, shepherds were staying out in the fields and keeping watch at night over their flock. Then an angel of the Lord stood before them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were terrified. You would have been too. But the angel said to them, don't be afraid. For look, I proclaim to you good news of great joy that is for all people. Today, a Savior is born, who is the Messiah, the Lord, was born in the city of David. I've got good news for you. And the fact that he goes, or these angels go to shepherds, should really blow us away. And we don't have shepherds a whole lot. I mean, some of you may own sheep or other yard animals, but the idea of me being a shepherd in today's society or in our area is not something that we do a whole lot of. And so you need to understand that shepherds were not exactly the big dogs of society. They were the folks who lived outside of town with the stinky animals. And because they lived with the stinky animals, they stunk too. Nobody wanted to be around them. They were the guys who you were like, oh, shepherds are in town. I could smell them. You know what I'm saying? You smelt them before you saw them. They were pretty much unclean, which had a variety of ritualistic issues to go with it. For example, because they were unclean, because they dealt with dead animals and all these other things, they really couldn't go to temple and worship God unless they were purely or ritually purified. So a lot of them didn't get to church a whole often. Yet God appears or sends angels to appear to this group. The group nobody else would have chosen. The group that you and I would have left out of our script. The group that you and I would have not picked to tell the good news to. And God goes and he informs these people, these shepherds. He doesn't go to kings or queens. He doesn't go to military leaders or religious leaders. The great announcement that God is here comes to shepherds. Now, we glorify them in our parades and in our nativity scenes and all these other things of life, but shepherds were not the people that were respected in town. They were not the folks that you spent a whole lot of time with. These were basically some outcast people. And God picked them to tell the truth to. Here's the miracle of the method. God will use ordinary people to accomplish extraordinary things. I know that's not really profound, but God uses ordinary people to accomplish extraordinary things. Now, you probably consider yourself pretty ordinary. Yet God can use you to do great and mighty things. God uses shepherds to get the word out. He uses a girl who's probably no more than 16 years old who has no kind of place in society, who will be shamed because of her obedience to God, which was a big deal in their society. She will now be publicly shamed and known through the rest of her life as the girl who got pregnant before she was married. He's going to pick her and she's going to be obedient. Despite the ridicule, despite all of these things, she said, I'm just ordinary, but I'll obey you. He picks this guy who has a lot of integrity, who is willing to say, I'm going to divorce you quietly. I'm going to send you away because I don't really want you publicly shamed because you're pregnant with a child that I know is not mine, and so does the rest of the community. They all know that this baby doesn't belong to me. And there's going to be a stigma on our relationship and on us for the rest of our lives. So I'm just going to put you away privately. And God says, no, you marry that girl. I've got plans. And Joseph obeys. At the resurrection, Jesus appears not to the religious leaders, not to Pilate, not to the guys who drove the nails through his hands, but he appears to his followers, these ordinary guys who took off and ran away when he was arrested. Jesus goes to them, the ordinary guys who was told about them, oh, he must be from Galilee because he doesn't know how to talk right. God uses the ordinary to do extraordinary things. That is the God that we worship. That is the God who changes our world. If we were writing the script, Jesus would have showed up at the house of the high priest the next day, if it would have been me, and said, sucker, I told you I was God. He would have showed up in the temple complex saying, I'm back. But he doesn't do that. His methods are beyond our comprehension. His ways are above our understanding. And he does things with the mundane things of this world. Things like a manger. Now, this may or may not look like what was there. Probably doesn't. But how many of you would have picked this to lay your child in? How many of you would have picked a stable or a first floor of a room where all the animals were, or a cave, wherever it was, where Jesus is birthed that night? And Mary doesn't have a crib. She doesn't even have a nice floor. So she lays him in the best cleaned out food trough she can find. God's methods are not our methods. The salvation of the world rested in the hands of these few followers that Jesus appeared to. The ones who ran away, the ones who were afraid of him, the ones who wanted to spare their life. And God changes the world because they went out and shared the gospel. Ordinary, plain guys, ordinary, plain women who told people about Jesus. God's methods include you, and God's methods include me. You may think you have no value, but God said, I can use you. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul talks about how God uses the foolish things of this world to confound the wise. And I think that wraps up this whole concept here. He uses the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. I am a foolish thing of the world. Yet the truth that I speak confounds the wise. It blows them away. You and I are the foolish things of this world that God uses for his glory. So the question is, are you using it? What God gave you to change the world? God uses the plain, ordinary, mundane things of this world. Are you going to let him use you? Are you going to give your life to him? Next week, we're going to look at the manger. But this week, are you going to let God's methods be used in your life? Are you going to be part of His method? If you've never given your life to Him, I encourage you to talk to me today about that. If you want to join a church, or if you want to be baptized, or you want to know what's next in line, I'd love for you to talk to me. So as Chris plays, will you stand? And you can respond to God. The altar's open if you want to pray. I would love to pray with you. If you want to grab a friend and pray with them, you spend time with God. And ask Him to use you. Our plain, ordinary life. To do extraordinary things. For His glory.